Stories, Threads, and Magic from the Life of Dennis C. Merritt, Part 2. Showdown at the Pembroke Dish Room, 1965, Pembroke. Back then, in the mid-1960s, Brown was a men's college, and Pembroke was a women's college associated with it. We shared classes, but the dorms and dining rooms were separate. One year, looking to make some spending money, I took a job as a dishwasher at the Pembroke Dining Hall. This led to one of the most dramatic athletic competitions of my life. It all had to do with the main dishwashing machine. It was a large machine that had a continuous moving belt of slots for dishes. Scrapers would pre-rinse the dishes and stack them for one person, the feeder, who would load the moving slots with dirty dishes. The belt moved the dishes through the big central processing unit, and they came out clean and hot on the other end. There, another person, the catcher, would pull them out and stack them for still others to put away. If, for some reason, the catcher wasn't able to pull the dishes out fast enough, the belt would bring them to a bar at the end of the machine, which would temporarily stop the conveyor. Can you see where this is going? It became a game, with a feeder trying to pack the belt with more dishes than the catcher could catch, and the catcher pulling the dishes as fast as possible to avoid that stop being hit. My job was catcher, and I was getting pretty good at it. The best feeder was Marty, a Pembroke student. She'd always try to pack the machine to its fullest, hoping to hit the stop. But I could catch anything she could feed. There was a knack to it. The big dinner plates came through two across, and they were easy to grab. I'd spread my fingers and pick them out four at a time. This let me work my way into the machine. Then, when a row of smaller plates came through, there was more time to get them before the stop. Marty was good, but with the smaller plates, she didn't fill the machine solid, and I always had time to pull them out. Marty was getting frustrated that she couldn't stop the machine on me, and she began to tell stories of a legendary feeder named Pete. He had been the feeder there for a while, and nobody, nobody could catch Pete. He could always get the machine to stop. I listened to these stories, and they were just stories, although I thought to myself, I could catch this Pete. Then, one day, Pete walked into the dish room. He had heard word of my catching ability and asked Mabel, the supervisor, if he could feed for a bit. Mabel liked working with us kids and enjoyed the competition around the big machine. She said yes. Pete stepped in front of the machine and started feeding. I'd never seen anything like it. He never left a gap. But I could catch him. Dinner plates two across, no problem. Then the dessert plates three across. Now the different plates came to him mixed, so there would always be a couple of rows of dinner plates and then dessert plates, like that. The bread plates were smaller. They came in five across. But still, I could catch them. And after a few rows, there was always something easier that would let me work my way back into the machine. Everyone was watching, and especially Mabel was enjoying the show. There was Pete, with a totally calm demeanor, loading the plates as if he were a machine himself, and me grabbing and stacking as they came through, sometimes barely clearing a row before the stop. But the machine never stopped, and it looked like Pete had met his match. Then it happened. Dessert. Tiny little bowls of fruit salad. Pete started feeding those tiny bowls, seven across, without missing a space. Seven tiny dishes in each row, and so small you couldn't grab a bunch at a time. Had to pull them out one by one. Now, Marty would feed those as well, but never so dense, and never so many that I couldn't get them before the stop. Here they were, a solid wave of these things. I was frantically trying to get them out. They were getting closer to the stop. I almost had them, but they were hard to get out. One was stuck. I yanked to get it free and wound up jerking it across the dish room, where it slammed into a wall and shattered into tiny pieces as the row hit the stop and the conveyor halted. Mabel cracked up laughing and said, "That's it, enough, before someone gets hurt with flying dish shards." I'd lost. Hats off to Pete. He was still the legend. He got his hat and coat, shook my hand, and said I was the best catcher he'd ever worked with, and left. Marty and I finished the dishes for the night. Rabbit, 1966, Brown. In my senior year, I moved into an off-campus, but still university, house. It was like a frat house, except it wasn't. It was just a dorm. I was rooming with Grant. Now, there was a kid in the house who went by the name Rabbit. He probably picked it himself because, well, he liked to fuck. He would tell us over and over how many girls he'd had and how much he liked to fuck girls. He couldn't emphasize it enough. There was another thing. He hated fags. He would describe what he would do to any fag who tried to hit on him. He wasn't a nice person. He had a stray cat in his room, and he'd put out food for it and then do behavioral training by shooting it with a pea shooter every time it went to eat. I can't remember. Did I mention how much he loved to fuck girls and how much he hated fags? That's important for the rest of the story. One day, Grant and I were wandering around in downtown Providence and went by a newsstand which was selling magazines, one of which was a pornographic gay magazine, Muscle Boy. I don't know which one of us had the idea, but we hatched this plan to buy a copy of the magazine, dirty it up so it looked well used, and hide it under the rabbit's bed. That part of the plan was easy. But what next? We didn't quite know where to go with it. Well, here's where Providence comes into play. There are a bunch of us hanging out in the rabbit's room just acting like college kids, and someone starts throwing a tennis ball around, and Grant hits it with a racket or something, and it shoots up to the ceiling and explodes this fluorescent light into a million little glass shards all over the rabbit's bed. The rabbit is pissed and yells, "Grant, you asshole, clean that up." It was hard for us to contain our excitement. Grant says, "Sure." And he pulls up the covers and starts to unmake the bed and then discovers the magazine. Did I mention there were a bunch of us in the room? Grant says, "What's this?" Well, the rabbit had a temper, and I don't think I've ever seen anyone as furious as he was. He was ranting and yelling, saying it wasn't his, no way it could be his, and that if he found out who put it there, he would kill him. Grant and I, we believed him, and never told anyone until years later about our prank. The Heart on Sales Hall, 1960s, Brown. On February 14th, 1966, Orrin and I climbed to the top of Sales Hall, the dominant building on the Brown University campus, and at about 100 feet, the tallest. We placed a wooden heart in the spire at the top. A group of us, all rock climbers, simply couldn't stay off the buildings when we weren't out at real cliffs, and when climbing buildings was, felt compelled to leave some token of our ascent, thus the heart that Valentine's Day. The previous Halloween, we planned and executed a military-style campaign to place jack-o'-lanterns on the tops of 13 campus buildings. We had three or four teams, each with a climber, a belayer for safety, and support for the handling and hauling of the pumpkins. The campus police had no idea what was happening until it was all over and our jack-o'-lanterns were smiling down from the tops of those 13 buildings. Had they any idea, they might have noticed us wandering about with our ropes, climbing gear, and pumpkins. Three of the scents were noteworthy. The first was Manning Chapel. We thought it impossible to climb, but Dick solved that problem by climbing a poplar tree growing on the side of the chapel. From there, he stepped over to the roof and, after hauling up a pumpkin, placed it at the front of the building. I don't know if those trees are still there. Carrie Tower was the second. Its fluted brickwork was climbable, but there was no way to use traditional climbing techniques to make it a safe ascent. That problem was solved by Tom, a graduate student who, having trained in the steam tunnels under MIT, had discovered an underground route to the inside of the tower. So it was really a spelunking success, not a climbing one. Note that a couple of years after us, Peter Blattman did climb Carrie Tower and also conquered a project we'd only dreamed of, the Gold Dome State House in Providence. Hats off to him. The third was Sales Hall. Orrin and I had thought we could mount the pumpkin on the spire on the top of the peaked slate roof. We weren't so smart. From the ground, it looked like we could easily get up there. But standing on the ledge at the base of that peaked summit, we found out it was much higher than we thought. So we put the pumpkin on the ledge and vowed to come back on a different holiday to complete the climb. The route up Sales Hall. The route for reaching the ledge was relatively easy and fun. The building was broken up on the side into five different sections, which gave the route a kind of alpine feel. It was 75 feet, half a rope length, from the ground to the ledge around the top. Oren belayed me as I climbed to the ledge, and then I, from above, belayed him up to the ledge. We then pulled up the rope, and Oren went round to the other side of the peak and threw one end of the rope over the top. I then grabbed it, tied into it, and used it to climb up to the very top, carrying the heart with me. Well, son of a gun, we still misjudged the height of that spire. No way could I reach the top, but standing on tiptoe, I was able to nestle the heart into a cradle-like feature that seemed almost designed for it. Oren then lowered me down to the ledge, and we both rappelled off the rest of the way. Not too long after that, the heart was featured on the cover of the Alumni Monthly, with a short article about anonymous climbers having put it there. Prequel. Before these assaults on the buildings, we had done a lot of bouldering around campus. Bouldering is rock climbing in the small, where you only climb as high as you're willing to jump off. No ropes or gear required. My girlfriend, Cherry, later my wife, and I had the idea of making a climbing guide to the boulder problems at Brown. It turns out my roommate, Grant, who wanted to work in newspapers when he graduated, worked for the university press and had access to its printing press. So we wrote the guide, and he set the type, that's how you did it then, and created the climbing guide to Brown University. What's fun is I still get contacted by current students interested in the guide. Epilogue. Later that spring, although we had no building climbing goals, I had gotten a parking ticket. Probably as a result of some bored dorm discussions, I got the notion that it would be better to put the ticket on the top of University Hall rather than to pay it. So we set out. It was just me climbing with a belay, going up the four stories of that building using the ubiquitous, sturdy university drainpipe, then walking across the roof and tying the ticket to a spire. My friends were hanging out at the bottom. When I got back to the edge, a campus policeman was down with my friends. And first, he demanded that I come down, and then, fearing how that might turn out, demanded that I stay on top. Well, I was about to rappel down anyway when he showed up, so I decided to be as flamboyant as possible. I made it to the ground in two big sweeping arcs and landed, raising my arms and saying, "Ta-da!" The campus policeman wasn't there. I asked my friends where he was and was told he was in the next building. I went in there and found him on the phone. I asked him what he was doing. He said he was calling the fire department to come get a kid off the top of a building. I told him I was the kid. He looked at me and asked, "How did you get down?" I was kind of irked that he missed my performance and told him if he'd stayed there, he would have seen. Anyway, that got me a trip to the dean's office. Now, to understand what happened with the dean, you need to understand some of the cultural events of the day. In the 1950s, Sir Edmund Hillary became the first person to climb Mount Everest. I know, and the Sherpa Tenzing Norgay, which is important today, but back then it wasn't. Sir Edmund Hillary had all the glory and fame. I mean, this was huge news back then. Imagine the first person to reach the highest point on Earth on a mountain that had killed many others who tried. Hillary was on magazine covers and the subject of articles and interviews and all that. In one famous interview, he was asked why he climbed mountains. He answered, "Because they're there." Everyone knew that quote. So now, back to me and the dean, with a story illustrating how deans were smarter than students, or at least that dean and me. I walked into his office, and he almost immediately said, "I have one question for you. Why do you climb buildings?" Oh, it was a setup. Of course I answered, "Because they're there." I knew it was a setup because he didn't even think before replying, "Okay, well, they'll still be there and you'll still be here if you stay off them." Catching a Falling Radiator, 1960s, Providence. The lead rock climber climbs above the belayer who is holding the safety rope. The rope is threaded, snap-linked in actually, through carabiners as the leader progresses. So if the leader falls, he, she will drop to the last carabiner and the same distance below. The second, holding the belay rope, must now stop a fall of what could be 10 to 50 feet or more. Today's climbers wear special harnesses and belayers use fancy gizmos to automatically clamp the rope to stop a falling climber. But this was the 1960s. Climbers tied the ropes around their waists and belayers held the rope around their backs, so in case of a fall, they could wrap it around their body to get enough friction to stop the fall. It took some practice. Our plan for teaching climbing at Brown was to find a tall, 40 to 50 foot high, tree and haul a heavy weight up the tree. Then the practicing belayer would have a second rope with about 20 to 30 feet of slack in it going up through a sling in the tree and attached to the weight. We'd cut the weight loose, and the belayer would have to stop it before it hit the ground. The belayer has the belay rope wrapped around his or her waist and is also tethered to a tree so the force of the fall doesn't pull him or her into the air. The tree we wanted to use was in a public park in Providence. We knew we'd get in trouble doing this, so beforehand we went to the head of parks in Providence and told him our plan and asked for permission. He thought it was cool and wrote a letter giving us that permission. So armed with our letter, old climbing ropes, a big old heavy radiator, and a Volkswagen, we went to the tree and set it all up. It worked great, and we were all doing well catching the falling radiator. Then, as expected, the police showed up, ready to put a stop to it. So I went over to the patrol car with my letter and started explaining it to them. They were fascinated. Now Dan was the next to try it. He laid out 20 feet or so of slack in the belay rope, and someone drove the Volkswagen tied to the weight to get the weight up in the tree. The police didn't know anything about rock climbing, and I was explaining to them how you stop the fall by wrapping the belay rope around your body. Dan was ready, with coils of slack at his feet. Cherry was ready to pull the slip knot on the Volkswagen to free the radiator. I was with a police car, where there was the anxious expectation of a circus crowd. The weight started down, but Dan, like Captain Ahab of Moby Dick fame, had his foot in one of the coils of rope. The belay rope tightened, but around his ankle instead of his waist. Whoop! Up he goes, feet first toward the tree, held down by the restraining rope, instantly suspended upside down between the two. I'm gaping in horror, hoping he's okay, as the policeman calmly remarks, "Oh, I see. You wrap the rope around your leg like that." Dan was okay. The Ultimate Card Trick, 1968, The Matterhorn. When I was around 14, I got interested in magic, and specifically card tricks. I learned a few, but can't say as I was particularly good at them. Also, it was a little disappointing that one could appear to do magic, but always there was a trick to it, which kind of took the magic out. I decided that I wanted to perform the ultimate card trick, one without a trick to it. That trick, I decided, was to fan a deck of cards, have someone pick a card, and then immediately tell them what it is. No put it back in the deck, no secret shuffle, no hidden shiners to reflect the image, no marked deck, no. Just pick a card and tell them what it is. How can one do such a perfect, pure trick? Luck. I figured if I tried this trick every time I had an opportunity to show it to someone new, eventually I'd guess the card right. The odds weren't that bad. It should work about one in every 52 tries. So at age 14, I embarked on my quest to blow someone away with the perfect card trick. I did this all through high school and all through college with no luck. Each time I would claim I could do it and proceed with the utmost confidence. And then, when it didn't work, I enjoyed explaining what I was doing to whoever had just pulled a card. but I always maintained my self-assured confidence until I knew I had guessed wrong again. Life goes on, and I wasn't that devoted to my mission, but if I was with some people who hadn't seen it before, and there was a deck of cards nearby, I'd give it a try. I'd gotten into climbing, and shortly after college, a group of us went to the Alps for a mountaineering vacation. Three of us decided to try the Matterhorn: myself, my wife Cherry, and our friend Kevin. The actual mountain part of the mountain starts from a hut that's reached from a hike up a ridge. Typically, that's done the day before, which is what we did. We were hanging out in the hut, kind of bored, and waiting for dark to get some sleep for an early start the next day. I was sitting with Kevin at a rustic table, and I noticed a deck of cards. I hadn't tried my trick in a long time. I said to Kevin, "I can do the ultimate card trick. You pick a card, and I'll tell you what it is." Kevin said, "Okay." So I fanned the cards, Kevin picked one, and I immediately said, "Queen of Spades." Now, I picked a different card each time, that's just what I said that time. And I waited, with all the self-assurance I could muster. And I waited. Kevin hadn't said anything. I was having trouble containing myself. I said, "Well?" He nonchalantly showed me the Queen of Spades. I'd waited nearly 10 years for this moment, and he's just sitting there. I said, "Aren't you impressed?" And he replied, "Nah, there's some trick to it." Epilogue. There's a grim epilogue to this story. A friend told me that the Queen of Spades is our card corresponding to the death card in Tarot. 20 years later, Kevin died in a climbing accident on the Matterhorn. Qualifying for the Boston Marathon, 1968, Cambridge. I like to brag that I once qualified for the Boston Marathon. Anyone who knows anything about that race is impressed. One needs documented fast times in one or more previous races to simply get to the starting line. That's how it is now, and has been for quite some time. But back in 1968, to qualify, all you had to do was send in $5. I did that. Now, I had been running some and thought I would do okay, but I spent the Saturday and Sunday before the always-on-Monday race rock climbing. So when my alarm went off at 8 a.m. Monday morning, I was faced with two choices. One, get up, drive out to Hopkinton, and then run 26 miles back into Boston. Or, two, go back to sleep, wake up later, make a big pancake breakfast, and go out and enjoy watching the race. I made the logical choice. Michael's Save, 1970s, Winchester. Dom DiVincenzo and I coached youth soccer for a number of years. Both our sons were on our teams. When I first told Michael when the programs were starting, he was really excited. "Wow, my dad's coaching my soccer team." But then a cloud came over him, and he said with all seriousness, "But Dad, you don't know anything about soccer." I told him not to worry and not to let the other kids know that. But I learned. We got training. It turns out the International Soccer Federation, or whatever it was called, had a meeting and decided to help third world countries develop better soccer programs. Well, in soccer, in the 1970s, the United States was a third world country. So they developed a technique for teaching soccer and trained the top coaches in the world to teach it. That was the A level. They taught the top American coaches, the B level. They taught those below them, etc. The program was designed to ripple down to the youth soccer programs. We had the coach from a local junior college come to Winchester to train us how to coach. We were the E level. It was good stuff. Dom and I made a good team. I understood the drills and what we were trying to accomplish, and he knew how to get the kids to stand in straight lines. Michael's progress was interesting. He wasn't the most athletic kid on the team, and often played okay, but uninspired soccer. But at times, he would get this spark in his eye and go after the ball with intensity and clarity of purpose. When he got that way, he dominated the field. I don't know what made it come and go. I guess it's like that for all athletes. Sometimes you're in the zone, and sometimes not. But when he was on, he was unbeatable. A highlight came one year when he was playing goalie. Someone had told him a trick for stopping penalty kicks, how to leave more net open on one side to get the kicker to kick for it and to dive for that open area as he's kicking. One day, the moment happened. It was the closing minutes of a close game. The other team got a penalty kick. The best, coolest, most athletic, and popular kid on the other team was making the kick. But Michael had his trick up his sleeve, and he was in the zone. The other kid slammed a powerful kick into the wide open half of the net, and to his and everyone else's surprise, Michael was there with the save. Frosted Chocolate, 1980s, upstate New York. My dad grew up in Poughkeepsie, New York. The drink, which is called a chocolate milkshake in most of the country, and a cabinet in Rhode Island, and a frap in Boston, was called a frosted chocolate back then and there. And that, by God, was what my dad still called it. When I was in college in Rhode Island, would go to a diner and he'd order a frosted chocolate. The person behind the counter never knew what it was, which frustrated my dad, and he'd carefully explain how to make one. She'd say, "Oh, you mean a cabinet." He'd say, "No, it's a frosted chocolate." I moved up to Boston, and it was the same scene, only with the counter person trying to explain that it's a frap. "No, it's a frosted chocolate." My dad refused to call it anything else. Years later, I was passing through Poughkeepsie by myself and stopped in at a diner for something to eat. The guy behind the counter was about my dad's age. I had an inspiration. I ordered a frosted chocolate. He just beamed.